From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guests will be Ellen Schaefer and Joe Brenner. They'll be discussing the proposal to privatize the water supply of Ghana. They'll also look at the approach the World Bank takes toward the provision of essential services in the debt-ridden countries of the Global South, and the impacts of those policies on the public health. Then, later in the show, in today's opinion piece, I will assess the impact of President Bush's economic stimulus program on the public health. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our first news item concerns the 5th Asian and Pacific Population Conference, which took place in Bangkok, Thailand in December. This was an unusual conference. With participants coming from all over the globe, such conferences usually have had extensive work to come to agreement on an agenda, and that occurred in this case. The agenda was to pick up on the agreements reached at the last population conference held in Cairo in 1994 and carry the work forward. 12 action areas were identified, including making family planning techniques more widely available to poor families, to promote the rights of women, to prevent the spread of HIV, and to reduce the toll of poverty on the lives and health of women. However, most all the attendees left the conference feeling frustrated and demoralized. Little time was spent developing action plans for the identified problem areas. Rather than move ahead with the agenda, the U.S. delegation had demanded that the entire 1994 agreement be rewritten. Prolonged negotiations took place over the terms that the U.S. delegation objected to, but these negotiations failed, and the conferees ultimately voted on each of the issues the U.S. delegation wanted to change. In each case, the votes came out 32-1, with the U.S. casting the lone dissenting vote. As a result of those votes, the entire 1994 Family Planning and Population Agreement was reaffirmed. Here are some examples of some of the statements the U.S. delegation objected to. First, the U.S. argued that the frequent use of the phrases reproductive health services and reproductive rights promote abortion. The U.S. objected to the statement that HIV spread can be prevented through consistent condom use. The Bush administration also pushed hard to insert language into the agreement that promotes what it termed natural family planning rather than more effective modern contraceptive methods. Conferees also reaffirmed the tenet from previous agreements that calls for abortion services to be safe in countries where it is legal. The U.S. objected despite the fact that neither the old or new agreements promote abortion as a family planning method. The reason such a prolonged attempt was made by so many delegates to negotiate with the U.S. is due to the tremendous power and influence the U.S. wields. Before the conference began, there was some hope that events at the conference might prompt the U.S. to resume its usual annual contribution of $34 million to the UN Population Fund. As listeners may recall, the very first day that President Bush took office, he cut off all contributions to that fund. The next item comes from the state of Tennessee. Last month, I reported on a plan being implemented by the state government of Tennessee that narrowed the criteria for eligibility to receive health insurance through Tennessee's Medicaid program. The first step was to re-register many program recipients, and the ultimate estimate was that 225,000 individuals would be cut from the Medicaid program as a consequence of the new policy. The cutback was prompted by the state's large budget deficit. Since last month's report, two levels of the judiciary have ruled on the request for a delay of the state's policy by advocates. Late last month, U.S. District Judge William Haynes ruled that the process violates the beneficiary's constitutional rights, and he gave the state 10 business days to restore benefits to those who lost them. The state appealed Haynes' ruling, and last week the appeals court ruled that, at least temporarily, Tennessee does not have to reinstate those who lost benefits. Meanwhile, in California, Governor Gray Davis has proposed cutting public health insurance for 300,000 families. And Missouri, Nebraska, New Jersey, and Oklahoma have already announced plans to cut public health programs. On future airings of Public Health Radio, we'll continue to follow the Medicaid story in Tennessee, as well as the health-related policy changes in the many other states which are facing serious budget shortfalls. The National Center for Health Statistics announced last week that nearly 25% of U.S. infants are delivered through cesarean section, the highest rate since the government began recording these statistics in 1989. The C-section rate increased 7% during 2001 to cover over 24% of all live births. 5% more women delivering for the first time had a cesarean section. This increase may be partly attributed to the increased number of women having children later in life, when the risk of complications is increased. In addition, the increased cost of malpractice insurance for obstetricians have made some doctors even more skittish about allowing women to go into labor. The biggest motivation for women stems from concerns about possible injuries to the pelvic floor, which can result from damage to muscles, ligaments, and other tissues during vaginal delivery and can lead to incontinence later in life. But critics of the trend towards C-sections say that obstetricians frequently prefer C-section because they can be scheduled at the doctor's convenience and generate a larger fee. And the critics also note that there is a much greater short-term risk from C-section compared to vaginal delivery. Coming up next, the privatization of water. Stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. There's no amenity of modern civilization that is at once so basic and so essential to the public health as the provision of safe drinking water. Yet, in many countries of the global south, access to safe drinking water is limited to only a small fraction of the population. Many of those countries are heavily indebted to the Western banks and cannot receive credit without the approval of the World Bank and the IMF. But those institutions have increasingly been recommending and even requiring higher user fees for water, even to very poor citizens, and have been requiring poor countries to contract out or even sell their water systems to private multinational water conglomerates. In Ghana, less than 25% of the population has access to safe drinking water in their homes. During the spring of 2002, a broad coalition of civic groups in Ghana, including religious organizations, labor unions, village leaders, political leaders, and others, formally requested the World Health Organization and other water systems and public health authorities to form an expert panel to launch a fact-finding mission to investigate a proposal intending to privatize the water system of Ghana. Today's guests were both members of that expert panel. On today's show, we'll be discussing the water privatization proposal, and we'll look at how the policies of the World Bank affect the public health. Ellen Schaefer received advanced training in public health at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and is currently an assistant professor in the Department of Clinical Pharmacy at the University of California at San Francisco. She's currently the co-director of the Center for Policy Analysis on Trade and Health, which analyzes the impact of international trade agreements on population health across the globe. For several years, she served as health policy advisor for the late Senator Paul Wellstone. Dr. Schaefer served in the fact-finding mission to Ghana as a representative of the American Public Health Association. Joe Brenner is the other co-director of the Center for Policy Analysis on Trade and Health. He received his advanced training in international communication at American University. For many years, he has served as a leader of the labor movement in the Bay Area in California. His role in the fact-finding mission to Ghana was to analyze the implications of the agreement on the water sector workforce. Ellen Schaefer and Joe Brenner, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Hi there.
Hi, thanks very much.
In the developed world, we really take safe drinking water for granted. Unfortunately, this drinking water that's pure and safe is not universally found by any means, and you've been involved in investigating areas where it may not be safe. And I was wondering if you could first tell us about the problems associated with unsafe drinking water.
Sure. You know, it is shocking that so many people lack safe drinking water, since it is so fundamental a requirement of health and human life. The World Health Organization has said that there's no single intervention with a greater overall impact on national development and public health than the provision of safe drinking water and proper sanitation. There are over 1 billion people in the world today who don't have access to safe drinking water. And equally, perhaps even more important from a public health point of view, there are over 2.4 billion people without access to proper sanitation services. And this has a terrible effect on the population, particularly on children. More than 5 million people die annually because of unsafe water. The majority of deaths are from diarrheal diseases, including cholera. Another 1.5 million die annually from malaria, which is not a waterborne disease, but a water-related disease. It results from mosquitoes breeding in unsafe water. And then hundreds of thousands die every year from diseases like schistosomiasis and trachoma. The tragic thing is that obviously we've learned how to provide safe water. It's not a technological problem. It's an organizational problem. And these deaths continue to mount. As I said, most of the deaths from diarrheal disease are among children under five.
I read through your report, and I have to say, as someone who had previously had no familiarity with privatization, that it's not at all obvious what gets privatized when you use the term privatization. So I guess that would be the first thing I would ask you to explain to the listeners.
Sure. Privatization of water can run the gamut, really, from a private company managing the operation and maintenance of the water system to outright ownership of the water resource itself. In the case of Ghana, the proposed privatization means dividing management of the urban water system into two what they've referred to as business units, leasing each one to a private water company, which will be responsible for operating and managing the system, including rehabilitation. But neither of these two companies will have the responsibility for extending the water system to millions of people, including, as it turns out, 78% of the urban poor who don't currently have pipe water. The current bidders in this proposed privatization in Ghana include the world's largest multinational water companies, the Vivendi, the Suez, Sour, and Bywater. Just by the way, Vivendi and Suez each have an annual sales revenue larger than the gross domestic product of the entire country of Ghana.
So it would not be exactly be an equal negotiation going on here. The companies would be in a fairly powerful position.
Absolutely.
And I guess the question I have is, as you just described it, it doesn't sound like they're actually asking the private company to do some of the most important things involved. And two of the ones that come to mind would be extending the availability of safe water to a larger percentage of the population, and the other would be making sure the water is clean. Now, did I get that wrong, or am I correct about that?
No, that's absolutely right. We were also quite surprised when we got there and read the actual terms of the agreement, because part of the pretext for this whole operation was that there is such a lack of available water. But in fact, there's really no obligation on the part of the private contractor to extend safe drinking water to any additional customers. And to the extent that water was going to be expanded, first of all, there'd be significant responsibility still on the part of Ghana to finance and operationalize that, but the formula that they were proposing to decide where the water would be expanded next really seemed to focus on who was going to be able to pay for it and was not focusing on where the need was. Not only won't people be getting additional water, but there was a lot of concern, and this was based on experience in many other countries, that even people now who currently get piped water or get water from standpipes and other sources would see their water rates go up, and that water would in effect become unaffordable. And we saw evidence of this both in the rate hikes that the government was already imposing to ramp up to privatization, and as I said, have seen some of the documents that are proposed for the private contractor, which would really guarantee them increases. It would protect them from changes in exchange rates and guarantee them a profit year after year, while not necessarily guaranteeing affordability for the population. And that was also fairly shocking. It's a bad enough problem that a lot of people don't have access to water as it is because it isn't there. The idea that we would start seeing shutoffs of water to people who already have it because they can't afford to pay was pretty distressing. The average salary in Ghana is about $1 a day, and the idea that we should be extracting payment from this population for water just didn't seem right.
Thinking about the recent article in Mother Jones about the huge cholera epidemic that happened in South Africa, it seems to me that there's really at least two separate things going on. Both of these two things I'm about to mention are encouraged strongly by the World Bank. The first is the notion that as much as possible can and should be privatized. Mm-hmm. And the second thing, though, is somewhat separate, and that has to do with this very neutral-sounding term of cost recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in South Africa, they hadn't yet privatized, but they were
right.
Forced to get involved in cost recovery. Now, I'm a doctor, and so when I use the term recovery, I think of a patient who's sick who's being restored to health.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like you to talk about what recovery means in this context.
Hmm. Well, you know, I guess it might make sense to just step back for a minute and paint the big picture of the context in which all of this is operating. And maybe the best analogy is to sort of remember back to when we first ran into the Reagan administration and the Thatcher administration and this whole idea that it wasn't appropriate for large governments to subsidize services for people and that it was just a better approach, and not necessarily because there's any evidence of this, but because some people believe this, for services to be delivered privately and for the delivery of services to be decentralized. And I think that there's that same approach that we started creeping in. We saw it with the devolution and the decentralization of government in the U.S. in the 1980s and difficulty for state and local governments still and the national government to be able to pay to keep up services that it had been providing pretty well prior to that time. Similar things were going on in developing countries, but probably on a harsher scale, because not only was there this ideology that we don't think government is going to do a real good job, but there were mounting debts because of loans that these developing countries were taking from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund that meant that they were really, in effect, hamstrung. So to the extent that in the 1980s we, say, had central governments expanding the supply of water, and that was going on in the 1980s, but as these financial regimes came into place, as the debt of these central governments began to mount, population increased, development increased, there were more demands on the water system. By the mid-90s, it became difficult for these water systems to be maintained at the level that had been happening previously. And that's where this idea started being floated seriously by the World Bank, that not only was it a bad idea for central governments to run systems like the water system, but that, as you say, this new term, new neutral-sounding term, cost recovery, came into effect. And it's really this, you know, rather startling idea, again, that in countries where people barely earn enough to live, that it was a proper economic formula to propose that they should pay out of their pockets for either the capital cost of installing water, or as in South Africa, which didn't go that route, for the cost of operating and maintaining water, for their everyday use of water. Now, you look at a place like the United States, which, as you've mentioned, you know, we don't barely begin to think about delivery of water in the U.S. Our water is heavily subsidized. We certainly can afford to pay more for it than we do, but we don't pay very much. And most of the cost, we certainly don't pay out of pocket for the capital cost of installing a water tap in our communities, and we pay very little out of pocket every month for what it is that we use. So this idea that it would somehow make these failing water systems work better if we found a way to make responsible economic citizens out of people in Asia and Africa and Latin America by making them pay individually for water was not only a terribly harsh economic prescription, but it took away from the government some of the tools that we have available here, for example, to cross-subsidize from, say, industrial and agricultural users to individual users. But this is the idea that, number one, that the reason these water systems have failed to expand is because of inefficient governments, which is not true, and that the solution to this problem is that people have to get used to paying for it, which also is fairly impractical. But that is the idea of cost recovery, that the way water systems and other services will become self-supporting is to find ways to get people to pay out of their pocket.
Just to give an example of what kind of costs we're talking about, in Ghana, for example, the cost of water rose by 95% in May of 2001, and the average wage, daily wage, what Ellen was mentioning, is about a dollar U.S. a day. People pay now, even, without full cost recovery, up to about 20 cents a day for the equivalent of 3 5-liter buckets worth of water, which is about 20% of one's daily wage just in water alone, and not even, according to the World Health Organization standards, sufficient amount of water on which to live. Compare it, for example, with somebody who might be on a minimum wage here in the United States, who might pay perhaps 2% of their income, and compare it further with in the U.S., what people pay on average for their water, which is about 0.6% of their monthly income. In fact, there's no provision, either in discussions that we had or in any documents that we saw, in the contract with the private company that had a mandate or a requirement that there be a lifeline to take care of poor and vulnerable populations. So there's no guarantee, as far as we could tell, contractually on the private company to make sure that poor and vulnerable people would be assured water.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. Our guests today are Joe Brenner and Ellen Schaefer, who were two of the members of an expert panel sent to the country of Ghana in West Africa to investigate a World Bank-sponsored proposal to privatize the water system. In the second part of our interview, we discuss the expert panel's conclusions, and we'll also be assessing the role of the World Bank in setting policies that impact the public health. Then later, in our opinion segment, I'll be giving a public health viewpoint of the economic stimulus proposal of the Bush administration. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today are Ellen Schaefer and Joe Brenner, who were part of a fact-finding mission to the country of Ghana in West Africa. The purpose of the mission was to investigate a proposal strongly backed by the World Bank, to privatize Ghana's water systems. And they looked at the implications of the privatization proposal on the public health in Ghana. Back to the interview. The next question is going to be asking you what the findings were of your mission. One of the almost inherent problems is you were invited there to comment on privatization, which has not yet happened. Mm-hmm. So it weakens your ability to say that privatization in Ghana won't work because you're basically predicting. You're put in a position where you're being asked to predict. And it would allow you to look at the proposed contract. You could do that. But on the other hand, if they waited until privatization was completely implemented, then it may be too late and very difficult to undo. I assume that whichever incredibly powerful company is chosen, they're not going to make it easy to back out of a contract. So I guess what I'm asking is how did you go about evaluating this? And I know one thing you may have tried to do is look at the experience that had already occurred in other countries. So I was wondering if you could get to how you carried out your task.
Sure. One of the key issues was the issue of transparency and whether the terms of the agreement would be known ahead of time, because arguably it would have been possible, at least the World Bank's argument was, that under the right circumstances, the involvement of a private company could actually bring some positive effects to the situation. And completely coming from the outside and really not knowing much about what the particulars were until we got there, I guess we were prepared to look at the contracts and talk to the officials involved and see if there was going to be some capacity building and if there was a lack of managerial capability or lack of staffing or, you know, something that was that, you know, you could argue that technical skill, that there was something coming in from the outside that was going to actually improve the situation, or if it was possible to predict from looking at the terms of the contract and what we were being told by officials of the government that we could see some problems. So the methods that we used were basically there were 12 of us there over a period of 2 weeks, and people took very extensive notes and laptops and recorded interviews. And we really met with everybody on both sides. We met with people from the parliament. We met with the party in power. We met with the party that wasn't in power. There were several water agencies. There was a water sector restructuring agency that was financed by the World Bank but staffed by Ghanaian nationals and that reported to the Ministry of Housing. We met with water engineers. We met with the people who worked currently in the water system in Ghana to ask them, you know, people, is there the capability? Is it a technical expertise problem with the technical skills were pretty much there. I think everyone agreed that the engineers and the people, observing the engineers, that the people in Ghana were capable of undertaking the technical tasks. We met with civil society groups, trade union groups. We had a meeting in one of the poorer communities in Accra is the capital city of Ghana. We met separately with a group of women because we were informed that women really have most of the responsibility for collecting water in places like Ghana and feel the brunt of it. If it's difficult to get water, they have to walk long distances. Their kids walk long distances, sometimes have to miss days of school because it takes so long to get water, frankly can experience domestic violence if they aren't properly providing water. So I met with some of the women in the group, including myself, met with the women separately to understand their experience of collecting and gathering water and what their fears were about what might happen under this new proposal. And I guess what we concluded is that there had been some discussion with people in civil society, and the women told us that they had heard, and others told us they had heard some news about this proposal to privatize the water. But there was a pretty high level of confusion and disinformation, even within the government, about what the process was going to be to approve the privatization proposal, and there was certainly very little information about some of the details that Joe and I have mentioned to you, which are pretty important, which had to do with the guarantees of compensation to the private company, which really means that the company, according to the documents that we saw, the private companies would be guaranteed a pretty high rate of exchange, a pretty high rate of return for coming into the country, which is important to know, and that there wasn't really a defined and agreed upon system for assuring lifeline coverage so that the poor would be covered. So, you know, you could say that it's going to be hard to know until this program is implemented, but I think that we were surprised to learn that even under the standards that you might hold out and say, well, gee, maybe the privatization proposal, if it had certain features, could be defensible, that we found just by looking at the plan itself, as I said, first of all, it was pretty clear that there was a problem with transparency, that civil society certainly wasn't well informed and wasn't well engaged in the process. And to the extent that we were able to review the documents and look at what the plans were, there were some pretty clear danger signals that this was going to be a tough road, that this was going to be pretty hard on affordability. And as you started off by discussing, there wasn't likely to be much improvement in terms of more people getting access to safe water, and there was not even a discussion of improving sanitation. So the conclusions were unfortunately a little easier to reach than we might have thought.
And to add to the question of how would we as an international fact-finding delegation be able to assess whether privatization would work or not while it's still in the proposal phase, we kind of looked at it in a two-part way, I would say. One is we looked at, first, what is the problem and try to assess what the nature of the problem was. And secondly, we looked at what is the proposed solution. And in terms of the nature of the problem, when there's agreement among all parties that we met with, clearly, that there was a need to expand access to millions of people who don't have access to piped water. But as to the nature of why that access doesn't currently exist, and what the solution would be to resolve that, we looked through many, many documents ourselves and met with, as Ellen said, a wide cross-section of society. And it became clear, for example, that in the World Bank-backed proposal for privatization, there was no consideration whatsoever through any of the documents for even a public sector option to be even discussed as well as an option for water sector reform. So some of the information was clear from the documents themselves that there was sort of a predilection toward privatization.
Now, I guess I want to pick up on one thing you, and your terminology that the World Bank had a predilection for privatization. And I guess in some ways that was another thing that's really surprised me when I was reading through the documents about the fact-finding mission. And that was that the World Bank didn't merely express a preference, they were basically saying, we are cutting you off of your credit line if you don't privatize within fairly soon. I mean, am I reading that wrong, or do I have that correct?
That's absolutely correct, and that was confirmed both in World Bank documents, for example, their country assistance strategy for Ghana, which outlined the terms and conditions for continuing loans to that country, which basically said the greater the amount of privatization of public services, including water, electricity, or power, rail, and the ports, the greater amount of loan money would be forthcoming, a direct correlation. The less amount of privatization, the less amount of loan money was going to be given to the country. The greater amounts, the higher of privatization, the higher levels of funding. And that was confirmed in person as well with the country director for the World Bank in Ghana when we met with him, who said essentially the same thing.
Now, I have a theory about this, and my theory about why he wanted, in many cases, world-renowned experts from the developed world to come. My theory is that the people who were concerned about the proposal within Ghana were saying to themselves, if we just express opposition, if those of us within Ghana express opposition, the World Bank couldn't care less. But if we get experts from the developed world, from many countries throughout the developed world, to come up with an official, good-looking document that expresses the very same concerns, that maybe that might it would be taken more seriously. Now, what do you think of that theory?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I would say further, it was also harder for the bank and other sources to withhold documents from us, since our donor countries are important to their funding. It's one thing to say no to civil society in Ghana, but it was easier for us to get some of the important documents and the information. But yes, I think you're absolutely right in terms of accountability and feeling that that opinion of developed countries was more important. I think that that certainly is the attitude, and I think that that's of concern in terms of Ghana's ability to hold their private companies accountable as well.
And I would add to that as well that there had been, as we mentioned earlier, a lack of transparency in this whole process of discussion. In fact, the larger portion of civil society was not involved in the discussion or debate about what should happen in terms of water sector reform at all in Ghana. It was rather a very small group that made the recommendation that there be this privatization. So I think it's probably fair to say that the hope was as well that the report from this international fact-finding mission would shed a light on the situation, also be an avenue to generate national dialogue and debate around this issue to include all segments of society to really talk about what's going to be the best route and the best solution toward improving access to water for the Ghanaians.
And I think that there's been a fair amount of success with that. I think it's important to emphasize that the National Coalition Against the Privatization of Water really enjoys very wide support. Again, among a whole array of teachers' organizations and student groups and women's organizations and the trade union movement, and has pretty broad support and really has been very effective and certainly got quite a lot of attention to our report when it came out in Ghana.
Joe, since you have great experience in the labor movement, I assume that you probably were very involved in discussing the issue of privatization with the workers' groups or unions. I'm not sure exactly what they have there. But was there concern there about de-skilling?
Oh, absolutely. There were several concerns that they had. And the foremost concern in the Trades Union Congress there, which is the National Federation of Trades Unions, which is equivalent in Ghana to the AFL-CIO over here, is the convener of the National Coalition Against Privatization of Water. Their primary concern is one of social and economic justice, that they're concerned that if a private company or companies come in, that ordinary people, working people, will not be able to afford the cost of water. And that's their primary underlying concern. In addition to that, there is a proposal to lay off half of the workforce. And there's already been some de-skilling that's taken place. In fact, even in preparation for this, there are a number of highly skilled workers who are working in the Ghana Water Company now, but there's been a pattern of hiring increasingly less skilled workers into the water company of late, which is already taking a step in that direction. Part of the problem in terms of long-term, in terms of de-skilling, is after years of relying, if it goes this way in terms of privatization on a private contractor, public systems lose the capacity and a skilled workforce required to resume operation of their system should they decide years down the road that this privatization does not work and that they want to take the system back. They won't have the capacity or the skills with which to do it.
In a sense, makes them a colony again in an odd way.
Mm-hmm.
They're become totally dependent. I guess I wanted to ask about the issue of monitoring, particularly public health issues. If when you were evaluating the proposal in Ghana, and when you reviewed what had occurred in other countries, in general, when a water system is going to be monitored, is there public health monitoring built into these systems or these proposals so that it's clear that the populace is not being harmed?
No, unfortunately, there was none of that in this particular proposal. There is some monitoring that the Department of Health, that the Ministry of Health conducts on cholera and guinea worm and so on. but there was no requirement as a performance measure to examine changes in waterborne or water-related diseases as a result of privatization. A sad fact that we learned while we were there, incidentally, this particular privatization proposal relates to the urban water system, but there has been a parallel attempt to impose cost recovery, as we were discussing earlier, in some of the rural areas of Ghana. And there's been, we met with one of the community health workers who was very instrumental in almost just about eradicating guinea worm from rural areas of Ghana, is very active in the National Coalition Against the Privatization of Water. And we learned from him that during this move to cost recovery in the rural areas, guinea worm has resurfaced, and there's now the second highest rate of guinea worm in Africa is now in Ghana, where it hadn't been at all before. The highest rate is in Sudan, where there's been a civil war. So it doesn't take much to find the health-related effects of these schemes. But in terms of requiring accountability and saying, gee, if we find increased rates of cholera or increased rates of guinea worm, then there's some consequence for how the company's going to perform. There's an explicit statement that that's not going to be required.
Now, I was actually, again, very surprised when I read that the reason that the World Bank has come out in favor of increasing the charges, the fees for water,
mm-hmm.
and that was that they had done a variety of economic analyses over the last 20 years, which indicated to them that it's actually would be less expensive to treat the illnesses brought on by contaminated water than actually creating the infrastructure for safe water systems. Do you have any idea how they valued a life, if a life was lost to cholera or to one of these other waterborne diseases?
Well, that certainly is a very pertinent question, and I think that likely the answer is the assumption is that treatment will be sought and that therapy will be provided, and you're absolutely right on point that that is probably a mistaken assumption, that health services, first of all, are not widely available in developing countries, and second of all, they have been subject to the same kinds of cost recovery and user fee schemes that we've been just describing in terms of water, so that to the extent that health services may have been affordable or available in the past, they're much less affordable and available now. But I think that even if you assume that they were right, that every child that got diarrhea would get sufficient oral rehydration therapy, which is now the treatment of choice in Latin America and in Africa, certainly, and that providing this to every person would be less expensive than the capital cost of installing piped water or other sources of safe water. There are a lot of different technologies available. It would be cheaper to let people get sick and cure them than to pay for the water systems and to pay for the operational and ongoing costs is a fairly brutal equation. It's saying even if they don't die, that the value of human suffering, of time lost from work, of future healthy growth and development, the emotional scars, the physical scars, are basically negligible. That the cost that we're taking into account here is the cost of oral rehydration therapy, which is a pretty cheap solution of clean water and water and salts. And that's basically how these things are calculated.
Well, it's not a perfect solution either. It has a failure rate.
It's correct. Absolutely. Right. People can't always get to it, and when they do get to it, it may not be a cure.
So, now, it seems to me that the recent cholera epidemic in South Africa related to greatly increasing the fees for water.
Yeah.
Might that change their thinking about it? Over 110,000 cases of cholera in South Africa? What would it take to change the analysis of the World Bank, people? Do you know?
Well, those are two interesting things to talk about. In South Africa, there was a cutoff, not just an increase in rates, but the government, and it was in this case the provincial government, decided to go along with this cost recovery idea and impose fees. After not having done so for 17 years, understandably, many people couldn't afford the water, and the water was just shut off, which resulted in a high level of cholera and many hundreds of deaths. Now, would the South African government rethink their decision to cut off the water? I guess there's been some discussion in that province, in KwaZulu-Natal province, about that particular policy decision, but on the broader level, whether there should be public subsidies for the capital costs and the operating costs of water, that's a real hard decision, and it's difficult for any developing country, be it South Africa, which of course has a small but highly privileged percent of the population, the 11 or 12% of population who are white, who pretty much do have piped water and sanitation, as opposed to most of the rest of the population, which don't. And that's in contrast to a country like Ghana, which doesn't have nearly the economic resources that South Africa does. Clearly, the solution doesn't come from the national government. The solution, as you were suggesting, comes from the World Bank, because that's where the finances and the resources are. And in terms of who's going to change World Bank policy, certainly the very vocal and active demonstrations of people in South Africa and in Ghana and in places like Bolivia and Argentina have been pretty important. But I think that there is a very critical role that we need to play in the developed world, in the United States and in Europe, in just demanding and recognizing how inhumane as well as ineffective these policies are. And from the public health point of view, I'd say that it's really up to us to retake that agenda. The agenda for extending water and sanitation to all populations is historically a public health role and a public health agenda. And I think that it's really up to us to come out through our organizations and associations and stand up as individuals and say, you know, the World Bank can run their economic analyses and they have their opinions and those are their opinions. But this kind of cost-benefit analysis should not be determining who lives and who dies, who gets access to safe water and sanitation and who doesn't. We know, as our public health organizations, the World Health Organization, just as the public health advocates and professionals that we are, water is basic to life. Sanitation is basic to health. These are affordable, technologically possible measures that we can take and that we can demand. The cost is minimal. We could provide clean water to everybody in the developing world for something like $9 billion a year. The UN has, if we do spend $9 billion a year for the next 20 years, we could take care of the issue. That's compared to something like $17 billion a year that we spend in the U.S. and Europe on pet food. So the Center for Policy Analysis on Trade and Health, which Joe and I are involved in, is very involved and invites all your listeners to become involved in actively demanding that we figure out how to make these water systems work, how to give them room to work, and basically how to provide the financing and make sure that the financing is provided so that national governments like Ghana and national governments like South Africa's can make decisions that are good for their people without a gun being held to their head.
Well, let me ask you to finish up with making that more specific. What exactly would you ask concerned listeners to do? And also, can you give us a website for people who want to learn more about the problem?
Yeah, sure. There are a couple. I think that we would ask people to look at our website, and we will shortly have statements up that people can sign, but certainly they can be aware of opportunities to communicate with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and also our members of Congress, both about World Bank and IMF funding, and also the terms of international trade agreements. It's a longer discussion, but there's an opportunity coming up at the end of this March through the General Agreement on Trade and Services. There's been a request that we here in the U.S. agree to open up our water services to privatization, and I think it's very important that we let our members of Congress know that we do not want the U.S. Trade Representative to agree to that proposal. Our website is www.cpath.org. That's www.cpath.org. Another good site for people to go to, and it's got a lot of information about struggles around the world, including in the United States, is the Public Citizen website, and that's www.citizen.org. And a final one that I would mention is the website of Public Services International, which is a collection of public sector unions around the world, which has also documented issues around privatization and some of the discussions, some of the arguments that we've talked about here. And their site is www.psiru.org.
Well, Ellen Schaefer and Joe Brenner, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Marvin, thanks so much for having us.
Thanks very much.
Coming up next, a look at President Bush's economic stimulus proposal and its implications for the public health. So stay tuned. On January 7th, President Bush delivered a major economic speech by announcing a set of tax proposals he would be sending to the Congress. His stated goal for the program was to stimulate the economy to hasten the end of the economic slump that has plagued his presidency. President Bush proposes a massive tax cut, $674 billion total. Economists have already pointed out that the proposal is targeted largely to the wealthiest of us. 60% will go to the wealthiest 10% of Americans. Furthermore, over four-fifths of his proposal will not take effect this year, meaning it would not work as a stimulus to help with the current recession. But by slicing up the proposal, one can lose perspective on it. The hardest part of the proposal to grasp is perhaps the most objectionable, and that is the amount of money under consideration, $674 billion. To the average person, once the amount of money gets beyond five or six figures, it becomes incomprehensible. $674 million doesn't sound that different from the $674 billion in the Bush proposal, but it is different. Let me give some examples. A total of less than $1 billion has been set aside for public health to grapple with bioterrorism. And that money is pretty much used up. So much so that Lloyd Novick, president of the New York State Association of County Health Officers, has indicated that there are no funds available for county health departments to implement the smallpox vaccine program proposed by the president, and that health departments will be forced to cut back on tuberculosis control and children's dental care for the smallpox program. And Rex Archer of Kansas City's Health Department has pointed out that other basic bioterrorism preparedness functions, especially investigations of unusual outbreaks and surveillance, have received next to no funding. So we have $1 billion to a grossly inadequate bioterrorism program, and $674 billion for tax cuts for the wealthy. Ironically, the war against bioterrorism would make for a better economic stimulus, since it would create jobs, useful jobs. And how about border security? Those of us who live near the Canadian border know how inadequate that effort has been up to now. The level of anger abroad directed at America's foreign policy is in good part based on the belief that America acts only in its self-interest. Earlier on today's show, we learned that $9 billion per year can provide safe drinking water to the entire developed world over the next few decades. But until those systems are put into place, millions of children will continue to succumb to intestinal infections and diarrhea each year. That's $9 billion compared to the $674 billion of tax breaks the president proposes. Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the United Nations, has created a special fund, the Global Fund for HIV, Tuberculosis, and Malaria Control, to address those epidemics. He indicated that to be effective, that fund would require $7 to $10 billion per year. For next year, President Bush has pledged $300 million. $300 million will go to combat the greatest threat to the public health the world has seen since the Black Death in the 14th century, while $674 billion, 2,000 times more, is going to a tax cut program for the wealthy in the U.S. Small wonder we're resented elsewhere in the world. We hear so much of critical needs here in the U.S. The problems in education have gotten publicity, but little financial support has come in from the federal government. And the massive deficits in the budgets of virtually every state in the country bodes ill for education. The same could be said about transportation. The near complete lack of effective public transportation costs thousands of lives each year on our roads and is much of the cause of our dependence on foreign oil. So another effective economic stimulus would be to get the construction workers back to work on useful infrastructure that could move us toward energy independence. Having a single-payer health insurance system here would allow us to provide universal health care without wasting huge amounts of money on administrative cost. But the reality of politics in this country is that the transition to any type of universal system will be costly. It is inexcusable for Mr. Bush to propose a long-term tax cut targeted to the wealthy while at least 42 million Americans have no form of health insurance. The budget crises most every state is facing will mean that millions more will lose their health insurance that they had through the state Medicaid programs. Tennessee alone will probably be cutting 225,000 individuals off of Medicaid in this next year. In fact, I predict that when the data come in, 2003 will be the year that experiences the largest increase in the number of uninsured Americans in the history of this country. Getting us so seriously into debt means that the millions of uninsured will be virtually guaranteed no help from the government for another 5 to 10 years because the presidents who follow Mr. Bush will be stuck paying down his debt. President Bush's economic package represents disastrously bad public policy. What's unfortunate is that all the harmful consequences of continuing to enact his proposals are long-term. None of the adverse consequences will occur in the next year or two. We won't even have data on my prediction about the number of uninsured this year until 2006 or so. Instead, enacting President Bush's tax program will move us down the path toward massive government debt and stifling rises in interest rates, while we have yet to solve huge social problems. Even more remarkable is the fact that Mr. Bush is proposing a tax cut at the same time as he is embarking on an expensive military engagement. And unlike the 1991 Gulf War, when Japan and several other countries paid more than 80% of the military cost, no other country is volunteering to fund the current war on Iraq. Historians who may be listening to this show can correct me if I'm mistaken, but I know of no previous circumstance in history when a massive tax cut was proposed at the same time a country is embarking on a military venture. I ask everyone listening today to take action to oppose the Bush tax proposals. To learn more, contact the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities at cbpp.org. Write your newspaper, your congressional representatives, and the president. Tell them that our priorities should be to implement an effective defense against the threat of terrorism. Tell them to do something meaningful to improve our failing transportation and educational systems. And no program of tax breaks should even be considered until we have extended the basic right of access to health care to all of our citizens. Tell your representatives that responding to these domestic needs will create jobs and stimulate the economy far more effectively than the irresponsible plundering of the U.S. Treasury that the President has proposed. Well, thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio. Thank you.